Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear. Vanity Fair.
Well, this might be the shortest GOP primary season in a very long time. Casey, is there any wild card out there?
If there is a wild card out there, Brian, it's not anything we can really see right now.
That is Casey Hunt, Chief National Affairs Analyst for CNN. She anchors two daily shows, Early Start and State of the Race. And she's just back from both Iowa and New Hampshire. And I'm Brian Stelter. Welcome to Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, we are going inside the GOP primaries, talking about Donald Trump's win in Iowa, and looking ahead to New Hampshire. So, Casey, you don't think Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley are the wild cards in this race? It's Donald Trump's to win?
I have to tell you, Brian, it is extraordinarily hard to see how either one of them stop Donald Trump's march to the nomination. It is just, at this point, obviously, anything is possible in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has surprised us all before. It's part of why it's one of political reporters' favorite places to be, because unpredictable things do happen. And I've always loved it for that reason. It can really change the trajectory of a race. But in this case, it's a pretty isolated situation inside the rest of the nominating contest. And even if Nikki Haley were to win and put a little bit of a dent in Trump's inevitability, I still have trouble seeing how that really changes the ultimate outcome here, especially considering, you know, Trump was so dominant in Iowa.
Well, it seems to me there's a frame war underway. There's a narrative war underway. But here's the counterargument. That means half of the Iowa caucus goers did not want to vote for him, did not want to support the 2020 nominee from the GOP. And actually, he's quite weak as a result. Clearly, you don't buy that.
Well, I think the reality is that in every other Republican primary, while you never saw anyone that dominant before either, right? I mean, there was never somebody in Iowa who got the margin that Trump got, at least in modern times. And yet, by the end, the party had a strong nominee. Now, Iowa wasn't always the place that, you know, ultimately picked that person. But that is an argument that I'm hearing from particularly people who don't want to see Republicans, who don't want to see Trump be the nominee because they think he's a loser in a general election. I think there's even some acknowledgement from those people when they make that argument that they know that it's still, it's just going to be so difficult to overcome his dominance.
Mm. And what about the idea that Iowa is so unrepresentative of the American people writ large, and even the GOP? Did it feel when you were freezing in Des Moines like it was a little bit of a waste? I don't want to say a waste of time. I know it's a beautiful American political tradition, but was a part of you just thinking, come on, what are we doing caring this much about 100,000 GOP primary voters in a single state?
Well, Brian, you are asking, you know, this is my fourth Iowa caucus. I am a traditional campaign reporter to the core, and I love this stuff no matter what. So you might get more luck on that with another person you're asking these questions of. But I do think that you're, and by the way, whatever we were doing in Des Moines, it was way more than freezing. I will say, even everyone in Iowa who normally mock us for not being able to handle the cold when we come in every 4 years, they understood this time, nope, we're all staying inside, because you were way more than freezing when you stepped outside. Now, it used to be that Iowa was a place where somebody like a Donald Trump might actually get tripped up the most, right? I mean, historically, there are many things about Donald Trump that are not conservative with a small C, the way that the Republican Party traditionally was conservative. It's just that the whole game has really changed since then.
That it's much more Trump's party.
Yes.
And everything about him has been accepted now by his voters in a way that it wasn't almost a decade ago.
Right. And I mean, there was an interview in the last 24 hours since Iowa. Ben Carson was on the air on Fox News comparing Donald Trump to King David.
Mm. In your interviews in Iowa, in your time in Des Moines and beyond, did you get that same vibe from voters? What did you hear that surprised you or stood out to you before you flew to New Hampshire?
There is a difference between how people feel about and act around Donald Trump than there is to how they act around what I would, you know, refer to as like a normal political candidate. And the reality is this has been on display since 2015. I mean,
yeah,
it was something that, you know, in the beginning, I wasn't sure what to make of it. I was there when he came down that golden escalator. I went to some of his first rallies in Iowa in the summer of 2015. And the reaction to and treatment of Donald Trump has always been different. It's more like how people respond to Taylor Swift than how they respond to more traditional types of candidates. Obviously, there are major differences between Taylor and Donald Trump, but the celebrity of it and just the way people are captivated by who he is, they want to be close to him. It's just a much different feeling. And you see it in small ways too, even when people aren't screaming for him, you know, the clothes that they wear, the way that they talk about who he is as a person, about how it's almost like it's very, very personal to them. And therefore a lot of the legal troubles and things that he has faced instead of being, you know, death knells for him have been instead things that have solidified support from his core supporters. I'm not talking about, you know, look, the people that are ultimately going to decide this election, they are swing voters, they are independent voters in a handful of states. And none of what I'm saying applies to those people. But if you're trying to understand why it is that, you know, 50% plus one of Iowa voters went for him, this is why. The Nikki Haley event I went to in Iowa, yeah, it was they had packed the house, right? They know how to do that. Traditionally, a traditional campaign knows how to, they call it crowd building, right? Like they know how to get enough people to a place to make sure it looks full, that the cameras get, you know, the right view of people being excited about the candidate. But also it comes apart as quickly as it comes together, right? So the signs that go up right before the event, this happened in the case of the Haley event at the Drake Diner, the signs go up, right? You know, hour before she gets there, they get the people to the parking lot. She comes through, she does one interview with a local station. She gets back in a car, a couple volunteers, they grab all those signs, they put them in the SUV, they drive to the next thing, right? it's just very different than what you experience when you are covering Donald Trump.
So Casey, as I'm hearing you describe the lay of the land, it's clear you're not one of those reporters that's trying to create this appearance of a competition that doesn't actually exist. You're not one of, because there's often a criticism of the press that, you know, that we want a long drawn out race, that we want this to go all the way to the convention, you know, that we want this to go on as long as possible. Sounds like you're not a believer this is going to go on until the summertime.
Well, look, Brian, I definitely, if I have a bias as a political reporter, it's to, you know, excitement and competition. And it's part of what I love about all of this. You know, I got into this business because I love covering, being part of our democratic system. And the suspense is great and it's really fun. And we definitely always, and journalists generally, like, we love a great story, right? And I think in this case, there was a lot of interest and excitement around the idea that maybe there would be a contest here if, you know, Nikki Haley had managed to eclipse Ron DeSantis in Iowa, we would be having a different conversation. And, you know, look, I want viewers to watch my TV shows too, right? It's in television. It's like the more exciting the story is, the more likely people are going to stick with you. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to, you know, say that something exists when it doesn't. There is, of course, the factor in New Hampshire that undeclared voters can vote in the primary. And that really would be the major difference for Nikki Haley in particular. But the fervor among the people who support Trump is still there. And, you know, one of my really good sources who I was talking to put it, said, well, you know, Donald Trump has space in front of people's homes on their lawns. His, you know, his neighbor had a banner hammered to the side of his house. There are people with Trump flags in their pickup truck beds. All the other candidates, they've got signs in the right of way, right? Places where you're allowed to put a yard sign that no one owns.
Right.
And it's just a fundamental difference. And it's true in New Hampshire.
And it's true well beyond New Hampshire.
When I say, you know, you're in Trump country, do you know what I mean? You can understand when you're driving around where Trump country is because you can see it.
Right. And there's no Haley or DeSantis country. But I think here's the obvious pushback or the obvious counter is that's a shrinking country.
Yes, that's right. I don't think it is expanding beyond, you know, where what we've seen. And part of why Trump is over 50% is that the Republican Party itself has shrunk because Trump has pushed people out of the Republican Party, especially in places like, so Polk County is the county where Des Moines is located. Mm-hmm. Des Moines is a very, it's actually, I mean, demographically, it's not a diverse place, but ideologically, it actually is. There's kind of two maps of Des Moines, one for where conservatives hang out and, you know, during the caucuses and drink. The 801 Chop House was the place to be, for example, on the night before the caucus. And then there's the East Village in Des Moines where, you know, if you are inside some of the cafes there, you'll see, you know, Free Palestine and messages about loving trans people, right? There are all kinds of people in Des Moines. It used to be that some of those people would vote in the Republican caucus, like mm-hmm. those people who used to be Republican are not Republicans anymore. So that has also really changed the makeup of the GOP, to your point. And I think the theme that's emerging, one of the things we also learned in Iowa, like the most telling piece of information, I think, from the whole thing was that 30% of Republican caucus goers told people in our entrance polls, 32%, said that Donald Trump would be disqualified if he was convicted as a felon. In, you know, we didn't specify which trial exactly, but obviously he's got many. 32% of the most conservative electorate in all of America said that. And I had conservative sources who would be happy to see Donald Trump be president again, most definitely want to see a Republican in the White House and a Republican House and a Republican Senate. They see that number and they're terrified because it says to them, like, there's no way if Donald Trump doesn't have, you know, 90% of Republicans backing him, he has no shot at winning a general election. Because ultimately, that's what this conversation is about. It's about who's going to be president of the United States. And the reality is it's going to be a relatively small group of independent voters who are going to decide, you know, whether they are willing to overlook all of Donald Trump's flaws because they're so upset about how the world has turned under Joe Biden. And I know Republicans look at Donald Trump and the biggest problem they have with him is that they think he's going to lose, right? The people that are most invested in, you know, Republican governance of the United States, the people who worry about Senate and House races, mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell, right? You ask right. him what he thinks, he'll say, well, the reason Chuck Schumer is majority leader is because Donald Trump lost 2 Senate seats in Georgia, right? So that trend and that sort of idea that the Republican Party is shrinking in the age of Trump, the Democratic Party, and particularly independents, the group of people in America that declare themselves to be independent, is widening, and that presents incredible challenges for our two-party system. That's also why you're seeing so much chatter this year about third-party candidates. People like, I mean, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is polling remarkably high as a third-party candidate. The No Labels ticket is talking about Joe Manchin and what about Nikki Haley if she drops out of the Republican primary, et cetera. So there's an appetite for something to be different here because the Republican Party isn't home to as many people as it used to be. And that's also because of Trump.
Let me fit in a quick break right here. Much more Inside the Hive in just a moment.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. We're talking about all things Trump and the GOP primaries with Casey Hunt of CNN. It seems to me we're going to see the Trump two-step now, where he speaks one way to his MAGA-based audience at rallies and speaks a different way in his victory speeches. Let me play a clip to show you what I mean. This is Trump on the stump the weekend before the caucuses, and here's what he was telling his voters about why they had to turn out to defeat the Democrats.
But these caucuses are your personal chance to score the ultimate victory over all of the liars, cheaters, thugs, perverts, frauds, crooks, freaks, creeps, and other quite nice people. That's a mouthful.
Right. So there's Trump saying, go vote for me to defeat the perverts and the crooks and the creeps and the liars. Like, that's very much an argument that appeals to his base. But that's not, obviously not a general election. You know, it's not going to appeal to the independent swing voters you're talking about. And yet, wasn't it interesting, Casey, when he came out on Monday night, he was this, I don't know, how would we describe how Trump talked, how he sounded on Monday night? He was a toned down, quieter version. He was a different performer.
We want to come together, whether it's Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative. It would be so nice if we could come together and straighten out the world and straighten out the problems and straighten out all of the death and destruction that we're witnessing. That's practically never been like this. It's just so important. And I want to make that a very big part of our message.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think the other thing, too, is Trump is kind of a master of using different channels of communication, right? Like, he's on his Truth Social platform saying and reposting a lot of things that, frankly, the reason he's not doing it on mainstream platforms is because he got kicked off of them. He's back on X now. Right. But, he knows that he's talking to an audience there that's different than the audience that would have to vote for him in a general election.
Yeah, I think we have to see what he's doing with that. It's dehumanizing language one day, and then it's let's have unity the next day. And do you buy the theory that's been out there that people have not been exposed to Trump in a while, that average voters who are not in Iowa or New Hampshire have not been hearing from him, and that's perhaps why there's been a thaw and an increase in his favorabilities, even though they're still low?
I think there's a couple things at play, but I think that's one of them. I think people, generally speaking, are tired of politics and they've turned it off. They've tuned it out. They find it to be demoralizing, frustrating, and just overall something that brings them down. And so their answer has been to turn off the TV, to look away, to not pay attention. I think that there is also a very human way of, putting bad memories to rest, right? There are literally scientific studies about how we handle trauma in the past and our abilities to forget, bad things that have happened to us and to not focus on it simply so we can kind of go on with the day-to-day business of living and worry about those things. So I think that Trump is in the past in a way that, you know, Joe Biden is not. Joe Biden is currently president of the United States. And it's always tough when you're an incumbent president and the people are taking a referendum on you and the job that you're doing right now. That is like inherently more difficult, I think. That said, I do think it's also true that we are going to be facing a much different reality in September of 2024 on all of these questions if Trump is the nominee. And that's going to be partly the job of the Biden campaign. It's part of why the Biden campaign keeps saying to people who are wringing their hands about the job they're doing to just wait. Now, I mean, I'm one of those people that, you know, I actually do, I question their decision to wait as long as they have in terms of like really engaging.
Wait to do what exactly?
Just the way in which they have, you know, the top staffers are all still at the White House. They're not in Wilmington running the campaign. The president is, he's running what would be referred to in older times as a Rose Garden strategy, right? Giving speeches. Being at the White House, running the country. They've really changed in the last couple of weeks. I mean, you saw Biden go to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, give a speech at the Montgomery County Community College about the democracy. And, you know, you've seen him. He was in Allentown the other day, right? They're starting, but they didn't start until, you know, the new year shifted over. And there have been a lot of Democrats in Washington who have said, like, hey, what's that about? Like, why are you wasting all this time? The White House will respond to that by saying, well, first of all, Trump's not formally the nominee. And when he is, people are going to, you know, it's going to start to register with people that, oh, this is actually a possibility. Like he might actually become a president again. Mm-hmm. And when we get to September and that becomes a more real possibility for people, then the question will become, do people remember what happened under Trump in such a way that it becomes not just a referendum on Biden's term, but one on Trump's as well? And I think the Biden campaign, you know, their job is to remind people of what that was like over and over again and through their various messaging to try and make it that way.
Yeah, again, it's the frame war. If it's is the election about Trump or is it about Biden? And yet I can't help but say to myself, wait a second, we're supposed to be talking about the New Hampshire primary and what Nikki Haley's going to do and what Ron DeSantis is going to do. And like, wait a second, shouldn't we pivot back to that? And I'm hearing you say, come on, like, let's be real.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that's kind of how I feel.
All right, let's hold that thought. Much more with Casey Hunt here on Inside the Hive in a minute.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They could go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
All right, let's dive right back to our conversation with CNN's Casey Hunt about Iowa, New Hampshire, and the GOP primaries. There's a, you know, traditional charter flight from Iowa to New Hampshire, the night of the caucuses. So what was that? I think it was your first time on that flight. What was it like?
Well, it was not my first. It was my first time on the press charter, but I have done that overnight flight four times. So I did it in 2012. I was on Mitt Romney's campaign plane overnight to New Hampshire in 2016,
right,
which was by far the most exciting one of these nights. There was a press charter. You may have been on it, Brian. I don't know.
No.
There were also three campaign planes, Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. I was on the Bernie plane, and there were two extremely close races in Iowa. There was the Democratic primary, which we weren't sure if Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton had won, but Bernie had come much closer than anybody thought he would to beating Hillary in Iowa. He was maybe going to win at that hour when we landed on the tarmac around probably 4:30 in the morning. Ted Cruz, of course, would defeat Donald Trump, but it was also very close. Ted Cruz's plane, Hillary Clinton's plane, and Bernie's plane all landed on the tarmac at the same time. There was so much suspense. It was honestly so much fun, right? Like, it was democracy at its very best. And honestly, I say all of this because it really provides a contrast to what I experienced earlier this week. Well, because this time it was us, a handful of reporters, a much smaller number than normally do this, and there was only one candidate, and they didn't have any press on their plane. They had a really tiny plane. That was Nikki Haley. We ran into her. She was there because we were unavoidable. We were sitting there waiting to walk out on the same tarmac. Ron DeSantis had gone to South Carolina. Donald Trump had gone to New York, right? It wasn't the same. And it really kind of underscored just how much smaller the whole thing was in the face of trying to take on Donald Trump. I mean, the reason why there's no suspense now is because nobody was able to create it in the year that they were trying to run against Donald Trump, is the bottom line, I think.
Right. And then you have, even after Iowa, Nikki Haley being interviewed by your colleague, Dana Bash, about E. Jean Carroll and the case against Trump. And Nikki Haley demurring, avoiding it, saying she hasn't been following it. So even now, as she tries to have some surprise outcome in New Hampshire, she's not taking that full frontal attack against Trump.
She's not. And that's because Nikki Haley, at the end of the day, if she wants to win the Republican nomination, she's got to win Republicans. And Republicans don't respond to that. I mean, this is the vice that they've been in all the way along, right? It's true that you can't beat Trump without taking him on. But it's also true that if you do take him on, you anger a massive segment of the Republican base. I mean, this is the story, Brian. I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, this is every day when I was covering Capitol Hill during the Trump administration, I covered the entire thing from the Capitol. And every day somebody would ask me, when are these Republicans going to stand up to Trump? When are these Republicans going to stand up to Trump? Do you remember it ever happening? It did briefly after January 6th, after the Capitol was actually
briefly
physically attacked. And then it took, I mean, January wasn't even out before Kevin McCarthy had gone to Mar-a-Lago and taken that picture with Donald Trump. In January, Nikki Haley was quoted by Tim Alberta as, you know, questioning Donald Trump over this. She has been singing a completely different tune since she has run for president. This is the vice that Republicans, you could argue, they've put themselves in there. They had an opportunity after January 6th to make a break. If they didn't take that as an opportunity, I don't see it happening ever. You know, I think that one of the things that I keep grappling with, and I don't want to end this on a dark note, but, you know, I was at the Capitol complex on January 6th, and
I was wondering about how you feel given what you saw firsthand 3 years ago.
And it's honestly, it's a very personally difficult thing for me, and a professional challenge too, just because it is challenging to everything that I thought I knew about how our system worked and about how people would feel about sort of the hallowed, you know, it's kind of a hallowed temple to democracy in theory, our Capitol. But that's not how it was treated on that day. And, you know, my horror at the violence that I saw on that day was something that haunted me for a long time. And I think that the even more haunting thing is how it has really, this sort of ugly version of what many people in the country now believe it to be, that it either it didn't happen or the FBI created it, calling the people who were bashing in windows and beating police officers that protected me every day are now referred to as hostages instead of being viewed as criminals. It is a very disorienting thing for me as a person who spent, you know, the vast majority of my work days for 10 years going to that building and trying to see the best in the people that were there from both parties to try and serve Americans. And when you think about what a general election Trump versus Biden is going to look like, and that 30% of people who think it's disqualifying if he is convicted, I think it just presages something very, very dark. Because if Donald Trump is going to win, which he is going to try to do, right, with all of his ability, he's going to have to convince most of that 30% of people that the institutions that we have are wrong, that they are not valid. And that's what he's going to put his energy toward doing, because he's going to try to convince those people that he deserves to be president. And the only way that he can do that is by tearing down the credibility of our justice system. And I think that that's what you're going to see over the course of the next, you know, however many 9 months, 8.5 months we have until the general election. So as much as, you know, I love this stuff and I was thrilled to be in Iowa and it was so much fun to be in New Hampshire. It's just a different kind of election. And, you know, I think I would just wrap up by saying every election I've covered, the candidates on both sides, they always say this is the most important election of their lifetimes. You know, that the other guy is so bad that like that voters must choose them instead. And it's always felt like the boy who cried wolf to me. It's always frustrated me when politicians have done this in the past, because they have all been people who have believed in the fundamental values of our Constitution. They are all people who called and conceded on the night of the election when they learned that they lost. Right, to the other person. They were all people who kind of abided by our norms, who played inside the system, who said, okay, you know what? If I lost, I'm still going to do the best I can every day to get up and serve my country however I can. That is very different this time around. And now we're going to hear both of these candidates say that this is the most important election that anyone's ever had in our lifetime. And I don't know if people are going to listen because they've been hearing it over and over and over again for all these previous election cycles. But I actually view this one quite differently than I view those other ones, when I never had to ask or worry whether or not there was going to be a concession call and that the person was going to acknowledge that they lost. And now the question is fundamentally different. The question is this person going to actually abide by what our system says that they need to abide by? And that is a very scary place to be.
Are they going to live in reality, or are they going to construct some alternative fantasy world?
Right. And send us back into a potentially violent place, Brian.
Yes. I think it's good to end on this serious note, because this is serious. Casey, thank you so much for the conversation. Great to see you.
Thanks so much, Brian. I love being with you.
This episode of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair is produced by Michael May. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our engineer is Gabe Quiroga. Mixing is by Bob Mallory. And I'm Brian Stelter. Thanks so much for listening. You can find me on Twitter and Threads at Brian Stelter. And we'll be back next Thursday with more Inside the Hive.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.